Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Clodagh Beresford Dunn. Clodagh Beresford Dunn is an Irish poet and curator of the West Waterford Writers Group. Her poems appear in international journals, including The Stinging Fly, Southward, The Moth, and Poetry 24. A qualified lawyer, she holds degrees in English and law and was sub-editor of her family's newspaper, the Dungarvan Observer. During her university years, she was an international debater. In April 2016, she received an Emerging Writer Award bursary from the Arts Council of Ireland. She teaches creative writing and public speaking also in Ireland. Hi, Clodagh, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Great, and it's really a thrill to have you here all the way from Ireland, so welcome.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be in Pittsburgh.
Okay, so you're going to start with some poems?
Yes.
Okay.
So my first poem is The Hush of In Utero Wash. I need to know if panic overtook you the moment you cupped two hands around the entirety of your new infant and supported her head and neck. I need to know if your focus was unbroken, if it felt domesticated when you fashioned your rope. I need to know if tracheal ligation brought with it ecstasy certain, if your wooden slatted crate tangled itself among the slats of your daughter's swinging crib. I need to know if you held her close to your neck for a moment just before you stepped up, if explanations settled on her face. I need to know if you were delayed by the miniature grip of her hand, if you assuaged her sobs with the hush of In Utero Wash. I need to know if gestational accord was abruptly fractured by her removal from your womb 100 days before. I need to know if you felt a jolt when they sliced through the umbilical tube, if you watched as they tied it off in an independent knot, if there was discord as they urgently cleared her airways and placed the interior floating weight of her on your exposed exterior. I need to know if the kick of your crate took her breath away too. Nailing the suicides to the branches of the family tree, atoms of gas. We failed to save you from yourself, your own worst enemy. The irony is that you inhaled and exhaled in order to stop breathing. The chill of filled cylinders let you determine the terms of your own termination. Deep breaths to depart this world, like your mother's deep breaths that delivered you in from the fetal curl of yourself. That curl to which you returned when you crawled into your car trunk and closed with your swan song, determination, self-belief, your coffin lid. Are people born with glasses on? It is at the tip of the wasp's sting, or under the porcelain tile on the bathroom floor, or embedded in a mound of utility bills on the kitchen counter, or written in tiny script on a wooden clothes peg. To think you had been searching for it in the Colosseum and in Queen Mary's doll's house, when all along it had resided in the inner spinning drum of the washing machine, or on the chimney stack of the plastic playhouse in the back hallway, or on a random potato peel tossed on the compost heap, or in the four-year-old's question, are people born with glasses on? To think you had trudged through the Theban necropolis in search of the poem, when all along it was alive and well on a sliding dishwasher drawer, or on the paw-marked television screen, or beneath the mound of salt from the upturned condiment set, or on the collar of a steam-ironed uniform shirt. To think you had dissected a concerto and moved among the brass and string and wind and beat until you found the soloist who guided the conductor, when all along the poem was on a baton of dry spaghetti in your hand as you stirred the pot of bolognese sauce. Coffee, juice or gin. Sonnet for four children under six. The espresso machine gives its chug-chug, Emily, who's two, demands an Easter egg, but it's breakfast time, and despite her begging, the answer's no. Her argument is dug into the table with her plastic mug. What's the stupid difference in eggs and egg? Five-year-old John announces, eh, g, g, spells egg. How do you spell, how do you spell, he shrugs. And as the infant milk heats by degrees and the twins in their pram unite with a cry, the coffee machine releases a high cloud of steam. Meanwhile, the glass for the juice, submerged in deep suds in the sink, seems teased by the gin on the shelf. You've more than one youth. I've been thinking. I've been thinking about fingerprints. Pad press on spongy ink in the fluorescence of a police station. One by one, and then a thumb. The slow roll and roll again onto record paper. I've been thinking about fingerprints and their similarity to contour lines on a map. Those rolling ovals joining points of equal elevation. I've been thinking about fingerprints, about impressions left by epidermal ridges of human digits. And that got me thinking about people and impressions, and how I once tried to get some purchase on maternal love. I've heard, after gestation is complete and just before birth, a mother's heart beats out one strong, long impression of itself. I've been thinking about fingerprints and how they rest unseen on the vast glass panels of infant care units, of how mothers stare at incubators, willing those hearts to keep filling. I've been thinking about fingerprints and how they rest unseen on the glass panels of Texan execution chambers, of how mothers of perpetrators stare at leather-buckled chairs, willing those hearts to quick stilling.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Clodagh Beresford Dunn, reading her poetry. So I love the precision of voice in your poems and how you're willing to go into difficult territory. It seems like you're not... You don't shy away from that. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little, the challenges of writing, you know, difficult material, and if there's any push and pull with that, any hesitancy with going deep enough with that.
You know, I think it's really necessary to just go into really difficult material as deep as you can, you know, to reach your hand into the very heart of things, into the fulcrum of the matter, and to try and root out the problem as it is. And that's the only way that I think you can tackle difficult problems is by taking them out and naming them. And, you know, I mean, these problems are universal problems. And I think, say, for example, suicide, which I write quite a bit about, it's something that, you know, it affects so many people. And there's so many things attached to it, sort of, and over the years as well. I mean, it affected my family personally when I was 9 years old and again when I was 40. So I saw it at two different times in society, and it just made me just look at how we've almost normalized it. And now as, you know, a mother, I'm trying to probably find answers as to how to instill in my children just the importance of trying to deal with this issue properly, because, you know, it's so important.
Well, I think it's very brave to go into that in your work. And but, you know, there are plenty of poets who don't go into the heart of things in their work, and or go halfway or stop. And so I'm wondering if, I mean, is that something you've always done without struggle, or is that, how does that work for you?
Yeah, I suppose I've done it without struggle. I mean, it's, you know, it's probably a form of madness as opposed to courage, I'd say. Yeah, straight in without struggle. It's just the way I would do things, you know, to go in and get them. And I think it's the only way you will find answers, and the only way you'll sort of take things out and deal with them. Because that's really important to me. I suppose, you know, part of this might have to do with, you know, maybe my background in law, that I was, you know, when you're training, you're constantly looking for the precision of solution, and you're relying on precedent constantly. So I suppose with writing, I just couldn't see a solution from the writing I was reading either. So sometimes you just have to go and try and find it yourself. So that's probably what I'm endeavouring to do with this writing.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Yeah, sure. Boomerang cracking itself against Uluru. Rudimentary kangaroos on bent wing blades, I do not hesitate to send this whipping through the atmosphere across continents, smashing through hemispheres like the trammel of Archimedes. Perpendicular spin on its own axis, its elliptical flight is stopped only by the crack of itself against the red rock of Uluru, where I know you will be waiting to embrace this aerofoil from home, pierce the stratosphere once more, and continue our childhood game of catch and return. Look, little brother, I stand barefoot on precumbent shamrock, its trinity of young clover like poultice reducing this swell between us. I levitate my right arm, bent elbow becomes arrow, pointing towards you. And as you travel further, our frisbee with its plastic rim, ready to slice through air like ancient discus between thumb and forefinger, from my line of vision, has become boomerang. Poem Net. Painted lady or tortoise shell, on the days the poems fly in, she is a net of fine mesh, held open and ready to catalogue. Her round rim, a conical snare, is light as blossom cup. It's a delicate extraction. She could execute their deaths in slumberous jars, and later, using long thin pins, she could carefully fasten the insect's outstretched wings against a porous board. Most of the time, however, she releases to flutter from right-hand fingers a formerly flutterless wing, and settles instead for tenuous imprint, a semblance pledged to vellum. Shaking off the detritus. So the editor wants to know why people are killing themselves. I'll tell you why, because they are part of a revolution they know nothing about. Not a revolution with guns and knives, but one in its strictest physical sense, the revolution of the geoid, the planet Earth. We might share it with billions, but these days we are each on our own as it sits upturned on its axis, slowly revolving, shaking off the detritus, until one by one we cling to the surface or free fall into oblivion. And so we concoct bizarre ways to dodge our turn. We are drawn to the oceans to hide, but drown in their deep waters. We strive to weigh ourselves to the ground, injecting ourselves like batteries with liquid lithium. To defy gravity, we anchor our ankles to balls and chains, or feel the ephemeral ecstasy of letting blood from our veins, while some tie ropes around their necks as they take their turn, ready to hang from the world like a tarot card I once saw.
I love that poem. You know, every time you read that, I mean, I've only heard it, that's only the second time, but when you read that poem, I keep getting these wild images of people hanging off the earth and just hanging there. And it's a really stunning how you make everything so from so small to so large so quickly. Can you talk about the writing of that poem at all, or that the imagery?
Yeah, that poem was written in response to a call out for a literary magazine in Ireland called The Stinging Fly. It's an excellent magazine, and it was being guest edited by a poet called David Lorden, and he had said in his editorial note that he wanted to know why people were killing themselves. It was a very strong editorial note, so I was putting in I was just sending my submissions, and that was a poem that I had been thinking about for quite a while. It was just an image that wouldn't leave me. So just before I sent out my submissions, I wrote it and typed it up just as it was. It was a poem that came through and landed on the page. So I sent it, and when it was chosen, I remember telling my sister, and she said, "Which poem has been chosen?" And I said, "Well, I don't really want to tell you because nobody has heard it, and I'm worried they'll take the children from me if they hear it." But it was, it was a poem that it was really speaking very loudly to me, you know. Mm-hmm.
And you said you had that image for a long time. Do you usually carry images around with you for a long time before they become poems?
Yes, sometimes, you know, there's a sort of a connection from image to image. So, you might begin to think of something today and it might make sense until 2 weeks' time. That was a poem, actually, I remember writing in the Tyrone Guthrie Centre in Anna McCarrick in Ireland, in County Monaghan. And it was just a very dark poem, and it was just, you know, a dark thought. And I could just feel the physical pull that people might feel. Because we have the third highest suicide rate in the world in Ireland. It's a serious problem over there, probably born out of the huge economic crisis in the last number of years, but always has been a problem. And it's a problem that really needs to be tackled head on, because it is such a problem. And it's, you know, to think that the one person that you cannot save someone from is themselves is the most disturbing aspect of mm-hmm. suicide. Because you can stand with people all you want, but if you can't be inside their head, and it's just a battle, and it's a war, and it's a war that nobody is fighting except oneself. Mm-hmm. So many people can relate to it, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you're writing these poems. And I want to say that if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Clodagh Beresford Dunn. So could you read more poems?
Sure, yeah. Specs. I'd sometimes notice your reading glasses dirtied with particles of dust, the kind from everyday life. Faint smears from putting them on, taking them off, your fingerprints at the corners of each lens. If you were in deep focus on your newspaper, I'd often say, "Dad, give me your glasses, I'll clean them for you." Afterwards, you'd be astounded at the clarity. Settle them on your face, look ahead with fresh eyes. South to your news, you'd declare, "My God, just like new." Today, a month since your death, I find your reading glasses. As usual, they need to be cleaned, but I'll never have the heart. An 18-inch fir bullet. My father Winston's busby, a heavy-haired bearskin he donned each day to stand in the archway of a sentry box at Buckingham Palace. Oh, tall, black, downy dome, red hackle feather embedded snugly in your dense pelt. Lighter than you seem, of course, tight stretched fur over a wicker cage. Nonetheless, 1.5 pounds of head weight to make wearing unbearable in summer, soaring upwards like a huge 18-inch fur bullet, it drew one's eyes from obsidian shoes, along sharp edges, trouser creases and crimson side stripes, up and over a scarlet tunic with a vertical equator of paired brass buttons, onto the collared garter star and petals of a shoulder rose, a gold-linked chin chain under young mouth and soft sloped nose, until one arrived at fur-screened eyes and rose, rose, rose to the skies on my father's Coldstream Busby. In the Busby maker's room, someone is measuring the length of bearskin hairs. Black bearskin from the red expanse of Canada's maple leaves. Not wanted or needed by a horse-backed Mountie. Black bearskin that will make its way to Buckingham Palace and in the rain remain on a Coldstream guard in a wooden sentry booth. My father's Busby before me on my morning walk, as an open poppy drifts to Flanders fields. Scarlet drops on fought-for earth, its brittle petals red and black like the garb of a Coldstream guard, and at its centre a soaring whorl of fur-like stamen. Okay. New smoothing iron. After Seamus Heaney's Old Smoothing Iron. To deconstruct women's work to physics, moving mass through distance, feeling exact and equal to the weight you have pulled, is to analyse every cog within a very complex machine. For instance, woman requires great precision to hoist a task and keep it airbound. Recoiling her arm with determined propulsion, she launches another and then another. She paces the relay in space. She paces the relay in space, bending and swaying to accommodate the momentum. Her eyes revolutions, her energy and her force at the fulcrum of such impressive velocity. You have become the hand rub of an Olympian. When your ashes return in a small wooden box, a brass plaque on top, there is no cord or record of attachment to anything or anyone. Somewhere a uterus is evacuating itself, a mass of patient vessels surrendering and collapsing, bereft of implantation, their futile existence spent. If we were to walk every inch of the earth or soar to a distant planet, we'd be utterly sure of one thing now. We'd find nothing of you except these ashes. Not your cadaver or the bony frame of your being, not the protrusion of your dental arcs. You've been reduced to chalky powder like the hand rub of some Olympian preparing to bar cling. If this box should open, one accidental sneeze might spell the resurgence of your skin cells, hair follicles, a glutinous eye or a femur bone. Rewinding, backtracking, you've been redacted to the nothingness of an atmosphere.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Clodagh Beresford-Dunn. And I just keep thinking about how strong your voice is. It just has such emotional depth. So I'm wondering about your obsessions.
I think my husband is as well.
The ones that we can talk about on the radio. But, you know, your poems about your father, for example, are so strong. And there's a lot of life and death in a lot of your poems, not just the suicide poems, but can you talk about your obsessions in terms of what's driving your poetry?
Well, it's probably like anybody's obsessions, really. It's the whole temperature change of life, you know, the hot and coldness of things, and the I suppose just the living in this world, and then the enduring living of having to deal with grief, or the way we absorb grief. And yeah, I mean, there's so many types of grief as well that people don't really take account of. I mean, there's the grief of emigration, which I write a lot about. There's the grief of passing moments. And I suppose I'm probably not on my own when I'm constantly looking at moments and wishing they were back again, which is just life. We can't hold on to the beauty of things all the time, and just a form of acceptance. And I suppose, yeah, my obsessions are, they're obsessions of just the human condition, I suppose, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, they're everybody's obsessions.
Yeah, I feel like there are. There were poems in what you just said, but we have time for a couple more.
Okay. The stringed instrument maker. The stringed instrument maker has labored over many women, birthed a complete orchestral section, countless violins, violas, cellos, a small island's harp, a voluminous double bass, even her own quintet of female forms. For months I dwelt on her wondrous silhouettes, considered how I would contort the words to force a finished cello, summoned the rise in her to return to her workshop, to complete the cedar back and bulbous belly, furl and unfurl the curl of the top scroll, insert the tuning pegs, and at the waist carve in the F holes for breath, thread the catgut strings, sedulously twist the end pin, cup her hand loosely on the veneer of the smoothed nuchal, and let her pirouette. Dense and central as a microscopic atom. Stickered windows opaque with indecipherable scrawl, tubular shelves at every wall. In the middle of the room, a glass deli counter stands loaded with home. This is survival food, parceled comfort within our small town. This is vacuumed nation, its air sucked out. Retail granules of Poland's soil cover Waterford ground. On the day we venture in, hunting those sausages for our barbecue, there's a palpable incursion into another world, a penetrating intrusion. This is precious and seldom, dense and central as a microscopic atom that holds all things familiar, known. And even if you cannot buy, you can hold and touch and breathe in and journey back.
The poetry of Clodagh Beresford-Dunn. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.